scripture is from Philippians 1, 19 through 21. For I know that this will turn out for my deliverance through your prayer and the supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ. According to my earnest expectation and hope in nothing, I shall be ashamed, but with all boldness, as always, so now also Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. Please be seated.
When Wayne said, I don't math, I can relate. I don't math either. But it made me think of my favorite joke of all time is a math joke. And it says there's three kinds of people in this world, those who are good at math and those who aren't. If you didn't get it, you will. Just be patient. You will get it. Thank y'all for being here tonight. Thank y'all for having me to be a part of this study with you tonight. Wayne and I and Cindy, we've known each other for a very long time now. Was talking with some folks during services this morning about it, and I got to realizing and thinking about I've known them almost as long as their kids have been alive. Not quite that, but really, really close. At least Matthew, almost his entire life. The first time I really got to spend much time with them was when they were in Homerville, Georgia, and I was doing a meeting down there. And from Pulaski, Homerville was a good 9-hour drive, somewhere in there, 10, 11. So it was a long way, I know that. About as far as I've ever had to drive anywhere to go preach. And I don't recall why, but for some reason, my youngest son, who was not yet started to kindergarten, went with me. He was still in a car seat. That's how long ago it is. He's 24 years old and married for a year now. But we drove all the way down there, and our kids got to know one another, and they're still friends. Christopher, matter of fact, filmed my son's wedding. So, I mean, they go way, way back. But while I was thinking about that, another memory dawned on me. And it has nothing to do with them. I want to preface it with that. But one of the worst memories of my life does overlap with some time with them. My wife and I had gone on what was the greatest vacation of our lives. One of the brothers mentioned this morning that they had done some investigation on me on the internet. Better be careful with that. You might not have me back tomorrow night if you dig very deep. But he said that he saw on there that I love Cajun food and Creole food, and I love to cook and things like that. My best friend growing up was from Louisiana, and I spent as much time in their house as I did my own, and his mom was a cook, and I fell in love with Louisiana culture and food and music and language and everything about it. So my family, we spend a lot of time in Louisiana every time we get a chance. And on this particular occasion, our boys were grown. They were busy in their lives. My wife and I took our first ever vacation, just the two of us. And if any of you have ever done that, you know that's bliss, isn't it? I mean, no kids to worry about, to get ready. It's just me and her. It was like a honeymoon, except we've been married for, you know, nearly 25 years at that point, over 20 years. And it was wonderful. We went to New Orleans. We spent the week there. The weather was perfect. The food was amazing. It couldn't have been a better vacation. And we're on our way home, and at that time, Wayne and Cindy lived in the Florida Panhandle. And we stopped over on the way, because they were about halfway from New Orleans to where we were living in Lake City. And we stopped over to stay the night with them. And they were gracious enough to kind of let us use them as an Airbnb without the cleaning fee and all that kind of stuff. But we stopped and spent the night, so we got to visit with them. It just was a great trip. But the next morning we got up, and we got ready, and we started heading back home, and we got a phone call. And that phone call was telling us that my mother-in-law had been at a restaurant and was eating lunch, and food got stuck. You know, she swallowed it, but it got hung. They took her to the hospital and had her checked out. Very long story short, they discovered that she had esophageal cancer, and she had a tumor so large in her esophagus that food was no longer able to pass by. We go from this week-long trip of absolute bliss in New Orleans to traveling back, to spending time with friends, to just enjoy, to literally pulling over on the side of the road and making arrangements through the phone to put my wife on an airplane in Panama City Beach, Florida, to fly her to Tennessee to be with her mother. where she would spend the better part of the next year, taking care of her after she had 90% of her esophagus and about 30% of her stomach removed. Taking care of her after that surgery, then taking her to radiation and chemotherapy every day, driving about, 50 miles one way to get her to do that. Literally becoming a full-time caretaker of her mother for almost the next year. Completely changed our world. Although she did recover briefly from that, the cancer came back, and August of this year was 2 years since my mother-in-law had passed. That's a perfect picture of what life is like. Everything is normal until it's not. Everything is good until it's not. Best week of your life, one of the worst moments of your life. That quick. That's how it happens. I've heard it said before that every one of us is in one of three places. We are either just now coming out of some storm of life. We've made it through and we're on the other side. Or we're right in the midst of it right now. It might be that the storm is raging in your life right now. Or you're moving towards it and you just haven't got there yet. And I think that's a pretty accurate depiction of all of us. All of us are in one of those three places. Obviously, I don't know you, so I don't know what your situations are. And frankly, that's good. I don't want to know because it might would hinder me. I might not would say some things that I really want to say and I think need to be said, but that I wouldn't because I know your situation and it might sting a little. Or it might stir up some negative emotions. I'll just go ahead and tell you, sometimes I talk about things, I tear up while I'm talking about it. It's okay. Pain hurts. God gave us tears to process that pain. Life is good, and then it's not. So then what do we do? See, all this sermon, everything this morning was fine and dandy on paper, right? Rejoice in the Lord always, and again I say, that's good on paper. That's great, and I see this all the time. Sometimes you go in somebody's house, and they got a pillow on their couch, and it's got the stitching on it, and it says, rejoice in the Lord. Or you go in, they got one of those little things hung up on the wall with the fancy painted, and it says, rejoice in the Lord. Maybe it's on a t-shirt. That's a great verse for those things. But what about when you get a phone call that somebody you love has been diagnosed with cancer? And you do what everybody does. You pull up the phone and you Google it. Esophageal cancer survival rates. And it ain't good. That pillow don't mean much then, does it? That t-shirt that you're wearing, you look down, it's almost mocking you in that moment. That's how it feels. But I want to go back to something that I told you. The thesis of this whole week is this. Joy has nothing to do with your circumstances. And again, that's easy to say in a pulpit. Somebody might respond, yeah, well, if you think that joy has nothing to do with circumstances, then you clearly don't know my circumstances. Because if you knew what my circumstances were, there's no way you'd make such a ridiculous, bold claim as that. And so, if we're going to make a claim like joy has nothing to do with circumstances, then we've got to be able to back it up. And that's what we're going to try to do tonight in Philippians chapter 1 with the text that we just read a moment ago. I want to invite you to join me there again. Philippians chapter 1. Paul's life wasn't always rosy. In fact, most of the time his life was pretty bad. There was a lot of suffering in his life. Everything we talked about this morning was mostly the good stuff. We talked about this faith family and the first part of this chapter, the first 11 verses of this chapter, it's all about the good stuff. Let's hit those again just for a minute, just to be reminded of how good. Paul loved this church. Now, I don't know if this is fair to say this, but I feel like from reading his letters, this was his favorite church. I mean, this is the one that I have a church that I call a never-know church. And it's not because you never know what you're going to get with them. It's because if they ever ask anything, I never say no. Even if it's inconvenient, even if I don't have time, even if I don't want to, even if I don't feel like it. And the reason is because in the 25-plus year history that I have with this church, I don't think they've ever said no to me anytime I've ever needed something. When I went to preaching school for 2 years, they financially supported me. When I worked in missions for 5 years, they financially supported me. When my son went to preaching school, they financially supported him. I don't think they've ever said no. And so I tell them, you're my never-know church. I'm not going to say they're my favorite, because I got a lot of favorite churches, but there's just none I love better, I'll say that. And I think this was one of those churches for Paul. Listen to how he talks. Listen to his language. Chapter 1, verse number 3. I thank my God in all my remembrance of you. Every time I think about you, I thank God, is what he says. Always in every prayer of mine, for you all making prayer with joy. There's our word for the first time. Because of your partnership in the gospel from the first day until now. Let's pause for a minute and talk about the until now. Now, we talked this morning about the first day. Paul shows up in Philippi. He goes down by the river on the Sabbath day. He meets these women. He talks to them about Jesus. They listen to him. They're baptized. The church of Christ in Philippi was born in that moment. And now Paul has a new spiritual family in that place. And do you remember what the very first, what is the very first thing, the only thing recorded in Scripture that we have ever of Lydia saying? Do you remember what she says? The first thing that we're told after she's born again into this family with Paul and Timothy and Silas and Luke, she says, please, let me show you hospitality. Come to my house. You need a, they didn't have a hotel room. I'm at a Holiday Inn Express. There wasn't a Holiday Inn Express in Philippi. Paul, where are y'all going to stay? Lydia said, you're going to stay at my house. You know why? Because you're my family now. She got it, what it means to be a Christian. We use the term that the church is a family, the family of God. But I'm afraid a lot of times that's just a cliche. It's a nice Bible cliche. Do we really treat the church like they are my family? I don't know if you do or not. I'm just asking that question. Is it just a cliche or do we mean it? Because Lydia meant it. And she put her money where her mouth was. She said, come stay with me. I got a place, you can find a place for you to stay. Got food for you to eat. You come stay with me. You're my family now. Then, of course, we encounter the jailer. And Paul baptizes him. And what does he do? He treats Paul's wounds. He feeds them. They rejoice there together. Where are they again? They're in his home. And so when Paul says that you have been partners with me from the first day, that's what he's talking about. But what about this until now thing? The book of Philippians is one of Paul's prison epistles, meaning it's one of the letters that he wrote while he was in prison. And he said that you have stuck by me up until now. And you get over into chapter 4 and verse number 7, and he's going to make reference over there in that text of how they continued to support him even in my imprisonment. And you say, well, of course they did. Why wouldn't they? Well, time out for a minute. A lot of times when people find themselves on the wrong side of the law for whatever reason, they lose all the support that they've got. I'm not recommending you try this, but you want to find out who your real friends are? Go to jail. Go to jail. You'll find out who your real friends are. There'll be some people who won't touch you with a 10-foot pole once that happens. Maybe they're thinking, you know what? If Paul is in jail, and they know we're his friends, they know we're his supporters, they know we're part of his family, maybe they come looking for us next. I mean, look, if they're going to round up people like Paul and they find out, hey, we're people like Paul, maybe they come for us and we wind up where he is. There's a lot of good reasons for them to kind of start taking steps back. And the rest of chapter 1 suggests that there were people who already were doing that. Because Paul talks about brothers who, and he says it this way, some preach Christ out of envy and strife, and some also of goodwill. He says, you know, not everybody who is out here teaching Christ is coming from pure motives. And here's what he says. The one, talking about those preaching Christ of envy and strife, he says, they do it, listen, supposing to add affliction to my bonds. I can imagine that there were some people running around saying, you know, if Paul really was an apostle of Jesus, I mean, he wasn't one of the 12, right? I mean, Peter, we know, Matthew, John, yeah, They're apostles, no doubt. They're leaders of the early church because they were with Jesus. They were right under Jesus. But what about this Paul guy? Paul wasn't one of the original 12. Matter of fact, if I remember correctly, before he became a follower of Jesus, he actually persecuted Christians. If he was a real apostle, do you think he'd be in jail? Imagine they said stuff like that about him. They didn't have innocent until proven guilty in first century Roman Empire. And some people were using Paul's situation and trying to make things worse for him. You realize how sorry you got to be to try to make a person in prison's life more difficult than it already is? That's a difficult place to be. That's not somewhere you ever want to be. Can't imagine trying to make life more difficult for that person. But there were people doing that. But not these folks. Paul said, you've stood by me from the beginning right up until now. Even though other people are turning against me, you're standing by me. Even though you might be in jeopardy, you're still standing by me. That's what he means when he says that you have been partners with me from the first day even until now. And I'm sure of this, he says. He who began, verse number 6, he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. So it's right for me to feel this way about you. Because I hold you in my heart. You're all partakers with me of grace, both in my imprisonment and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel. God is my witness how I yearn for you all with the affection of Jesus Christ. And it's my prayer that your love may abound more and more with knowledge and all discernment, so that you may approve what is excellent and so be pure and blameless for the day of Christ, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God. I want to suggest something to you. If we are going to bring joy to the world, number one, we have to be people who have joy personally. Because people aren't going to buy what we're selling if they don't see it in us. We need to be people of joy, but we also need to be people who bring joy. What God wants for us, all the things that God blesses us with, God never intended for us to be reservoirs for His blessings. The gifts that God gives to us, the blessings that He pours on us, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faith, all that stuff, God doesn't intend for us to be a receptacle, a reservoir that takes it in and holds it. What He intends for us to be is conduits through whom these things flow out onto other people. And so, yes, the love of God flows into me and then does what? It flows out onto other people as it flows through me. Yes, the joy of God fills my heart and then it spills out onto the people that are around me. I have to be someone who has joy in me, but I also need to be someone who brings joy to the people around me. I knew a guy one time that had a sign in his office that said, "Everyone who comes into this office brings joy. Some when they arrive, some when they leave." Well, we got to be people who are filled with joy and people who bring joy if we're going to be able to bring joy to the world. But back to the original question. So, how do I have joy in my worst moments? How in the world am I? Okay, you get that phone call. That thing happens. You get that bad news. It could be marriage trouble. It could be problems with your children, problems with your finances, problems with your job, problems with your health. I mean, there's all sorts of problems. Every one of us, we all have problems, and all of those problems want to rob our joy. So how in the world do I rejoice in all circumstances? The passage that our brother read for us a moment ago contains the answer. Philippians chapter 1. Paul says this in verse number 20. It's my eager expectation and hope that I will not at all be ashamed, but that with full courage, now as always, listen to this part, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For me to live is Christ and to die is gain. Christ will be honored in my body, whether it's by life or by death. No matter what my circumstances are. Even if this kills me. And by the way, spoiler alert, it does. He's going to be beheaded a few years later. Even if this kills me, I'm going to glorify Christ in this, in my body. Even if I survive, even if I make it through, if I make it through this storm and I come out the other side, you know what I'm going to come out the other side doing? Praising God, glorifying Him. Here's what I want to suggest to you. If you want to be able to rejoice no matter what the circumstances, you've got to make a decision. It's not something that just naturally happens. It's not something that our body just does. It's something that we choose to do. And here's what that choice is. You have got to choose that you are going to find a purpose for your pain. The worst pain in the world is the pain that is unexplained. Doc, my shoulder, it's driving me crazy. My back, I can't get any relief. I put an ice pack on it, put heat on it, take Tylenol. I can't get any relief. And so you go to the doctor, you say, well, what do I need to do? And they say, well, here's what I think it is. And you try that, and it doesn't work. Pain doesn't go away. They say, well, okay, well, maybe it's this. And so we try this, and you do that, and the pain doesn't go away. Okay, well, now we're going to try this. You ever felt like that poor lady that had the issue of blood that we're told that she had spent everything she had trying to find a cure and still wasn't any better off? You ever felt like that, trying to find an answer for what's wrong? You see, we can deal with pain if we know there's a reason for it. Because if there's a reason for it, then oftentimes it means there's a solution to it. And even if there's not a solution to it, I'll give you a perfect example. If someone, and I hope nobody in here is about to have a baby. If so, please forgive me. Tune it out. Plug your ears up, what I'm fixing to say. If you had no knowledge of how human beings came into the world, you're an alien who comes here from another planet, you don't have any idea about it, and somebody gave you a book and you read a description of a child, you know, a child growing and what it does to your body, and then the pain of childbirth and what it does to your body, I don't think anybody would ever have a child if they read this reads like a horror movie. Yet there's no shortage of people around. I mean, we're filling up the world more so than ever before. Why? Because no matter how painful and no matter what the repercussions and the consequences of bearing and delivering a child, every mama in here knows there's a purpose for that pain. And when you get done and you're looking at that little thing that looks just like you, and you love like you've never loved anything before. I told somebody one time, I think it was my boys, I was talking to them. They told me a few years ago that they had met these girls that they loved. And I said, you don't even know what love is. And I said, you think you know what love is? Why do you have a child? You don't know love you had known before. And the best way I described it to them was I said, it's like there was this room in my heart that I didn't even know was there. It's like a door that had always been locked. And, you know, I love my mom and daddy. I love my grandparents. I love my wife. You know, I love fudge rounds, as we've established very clearly. There's a lot of things I love, but when they handed me my son, it was like God opened a door in my heart and said, now look at all this. You didn't even know this was here. Why do women endure what they endure for a child? Because there's a purpose for that pain. And it's that little thing that you love more than you love your own life. More than you love your own health, more than you love your own body, more than you love anything you've ever known you could love before. See, the pain, it's not just arbitrary pain, meaningless pain. There's a purpose for it. The pain leads to something. And by the way, this is what motivated Jesus. Remember Hebrews 12? He tells us in verses 1 and 2 about running our race and laying aside the things that weigh us down. And then he tells us we should do this. He said, look to Jesus, who is the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him. What was it? The joy that was set before him endured the cross, despised the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the Father. Consider him who endured such contradiction of sin against himself, lest otherwise you grow weary and faint. And so simply, whoever wrote Hebrews, I don't know who wrote it, but simply what that message is telling us is this. How was it that Jesus was able to endure the pain of the cross? Endure the feeling alienated from the Father? You know, why have you forsaken? How did he endure that? He says it was for the joy that was set before him. There was a purpose for his pain. You've probably seen that picture. It used to be in Hobby Lobby all the time. It said, when he was on the cross, you were on his mind. That's how. That's how he endured it. Because it wasn't just arbitrary pain. It wasn't, okay, you're going to go to earth and you're going to suffer and you're going to be tortured and you're going to die this slow, painful, horrible, shameful, awful death. There's a reason why these things are going to happen. And why you can endure it is because of the joy that is awaiting on the other side of the pain. So he could rejoice even in his sufferings. Why? Because he knew that he had a purpose for what he was doing. It wasn't meaningless. It wasn't pointless. And you say, well, how in the world does this apply to me? Listen to Paul again. I've made up my mind. Christ will be honored in my body. The purpose that Paul made a commitment in his life. Paul's purpose was this. No matter what, my purpose in existence is to magnify God. That's my purpose. If you want to be able to rejoice in any situation that you're in, make it your purpose in life to magnify God. In life or in death. In blessings and in sufferings. Now everybody wants to magnify God in their blessing, right? Everybody wants to be the one that gets the unexpected fortune. You know, somehow I inherit millions of dollars and I'm going to use that. You know, if I ever came into millions of dollars, here's what I would do. I'd pay off people's medical debts. That's what I'd go to the hospital and say, pull up your medical debts. And people who have all this medical debt and they can't afford it, and I'll write you a check. Or people who need to have surgeries and they can't afford it. Or dental treatment and they can't afford it. Tell me who you got on your list. I'll write the check and you can do it. And you ever played that game where you think about all the wonderful things that you would do if God blessed you with abundance like that? Probably all played that game. Let me tell you what's a better game to play. Because it's more likely to happen. What am I going to do if I find out I have a debilitating disease? How will I glorify God in that? What if someone I love dearly dies? How can I magnify God? You say, you can't. What are you talking about? Have you read the book of Job yet? What was the accusation? You know, the only reason that Job serves you is because, well, you've bribed him, basically. I mean, look at the guy's life. Who wouldn't serve you? He's not going to bite the hand that feeds him. He's got enough sense not to go against you. He's got a good thing going here. But if you take all of that away, then Job's commitment to you will go with it. You know the story of Job. I was making a joke. You know the story of Job. Job lost everything. And you say, well, he didn't lose his wife. Yes, he did. She didn't die, but she gave up on him. Now, I'm not bad-mouthing her. I mean, she suffered everything that Job suffered too, by the way. Don't forget that. She lost her children too. She lost her livelihood too. She was watching her husband suffer too. But she said to him, if you have any integrity left, you'll curse God and kill yourself. Job lost it all. And yet, what did he do? Naked came I into this world, and naked will I return. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Job fell down and worshiped in his worst moments. You know why? Because like Paul, Job had made up his mind that God was going to be magnified in him in life or death. When Job had everything, when God blessed him with abundance, what did he do? He would go and he would offer those sacrifices on behalf of himself and his family, and he would praise God. In other words, when things were good, what did Job do? He praised and magnified God. When things were bad, what did Job do? He praised and magnified God. What did Paul do? The exact same thing. Why? Because he'd made up his mind that I'm going to magnify God in my body, in good times or bad, life or death. Now, I want to give you something to help you do that. It's three little questions. The next time you find yourself in some awful situation and you're struggling with, how do I magnify God in this? Help me, Lord, help me find a purpose for this pain that I feel because it's about to crush me. How can you still have joy that will sustain you in your worst moments? Ask these three questions. Question number one, what would God have me to do? Simple question. Whatever your situation is, just ask this question. God, what do you want? What would God want me to do? Now, you have the wisdom of Scripture, and hopefully you have the influence of your Christian community to help you answer that question. It's not always an easy question to answer, but there is an answer. What would God have me to do? Whatever that is, do it. Whatever that is. Question number two. What could God be trying to teach me or produce in me in this moment? Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that all suffering that happens is God doing. You know, sometimes God does chastise us, put us in difficult circumstances. Sometimes it's just things that bad things happen in life. They just happen because we live in a fallen creation that is subject to decay and evil. And so sometimes bad things happen. But remember that purpose for the pain thing. What would God have me? Maybe what I can learn in this moment is patience. Maybe that's what I can learn from this situation. And by the way, patience is fruit of the Spirit, right? Love, joy, peace, patience. Maybe what God wants me to learn in this moment is that I'm not in control of everything like I think I am. You know, we like to be little gods. We run around and we control our own worlds and we manage everything. And we don't, as a God, you're busy. You got all kind of stuff to take care of. I can manage my life. I can handle my life. And then there's something that comes up, it lands in your lap that's too big for you to handle. Maybe in that moment what God wants you to learn is to depend upon Him. One of my favorite quotes says, "You'll never know that Christ is all you need until Christ is all you have." You have to lose everything sometimes to realize that Christ is all you really need. Sometimes it all has to be stripped away and you realize that's really all I have in this life. As much as I love my wife and my children and my parents, I have no power whatsoever to stop bad things from happening to them. I am powerless and they will all be taken away from me. Or I'll be taken away from them. That is a fact. And I am powerless to stop it. But nothing and no one can take Jesus from me. Nothing. And He won't abandon me. I'll never leave you. I'll never forsake you. Question number three. How can I glorify God in this? How can I glorify God in this? I'm not going to give literal examples. But I want you to think about circumstances in your own life. It may have to do with your marriage. It may have to do with your kids. It may have to do with your finances. It may have to do with your health. It may have to do, this happens a lot of times too. When I moved down to Florida, here's what I learned. I grew up in a town with 27 churches of Christ. We don't even have 27,000 people in my county. There was literally a congregation for every 1,000 people in my home. Now, I moved to Muscle Shoals, Alabama. I play a little game when we have visitors. I live 10 miles outside of the city of Florence. Highway 72 is the main road that runs between my house and Florence, Alabama. And I play a game when we have visitors the first time. I say, okay, we're going to leave my house. We're going to drive 10 miles. Guess how many churches of Christ we're going to pass between now and when we get into Florence? Nobody's ever gotten it right. They've all guessed it wrong by double. People used to say 4, 5, it's 10. And that's just on the main highway. Statistically speaking, there are more churches of Christ in the Shoals area than anywhere else in the world per capita. There are over 200 congregations where I live that I could be to any one of them within 30 minutes. Sounds great, doesn't it? Until there's a problem. And then what do we tend to do when there's a problem in our congregation? Dude, I ain't even got to go a mile down the road and I find another one. Now, when I moved to Florida, it was different. There's not a lot of churches down there. And what I learned down there was when we have problems, we got to learn to work it out. We got to figure it out. Because there's not just somewhere convenient you can go to down the road. So whatever your problems are, whatever it is that might be robbing you, it might be congregational problems. Maybe you don't like somebody here. Maybe you don't like the leadership. Maybe the leadership doesn't like you. I don't know what it is. The problems that we have, ask this question. What would God have me to do? What could God be trying to teach me? And number three, how can I glorify Him in this? And sometimes God says, glorify me through your sufferings. That's how Jesus glorified the Father, was through His sufferings. Now, I wish that I could close with some cute little story or funny little joke or some happy little illustration. But folks, I'm just going to be honest with you. Sometimes the secret to joy is just accepting there's going to be pain in life. But I've got a purpose. And my purpose is to magnify Jesus no matter what. And so whatever I'm going through, I'm not saying it's not going to hurt. I'm not saying it might feel like it's going to kill you. I'm just saying you have a purpose, and that purpose is to figure out how you can glorify God through what you're going through. That's how Paul was able to rejoice even in his sufferings. So what about me and you? Can we do that? Oh, we can do it. There's no doubt we can. The Bible's filled with examples of people who did. The real question is this. Are we willing to do that? If we want to, we can just wallow in our misery. And if you are doing that, I'm not judging you. Believe me. I've wallowed more than a hog in my misery in my life. But here's what I learned. It didn't make anything better. It didn't take the pain away. It didn't fix the problems. It just made me miserable. It was when someone taught me how to find a purpose for my pain and how to magnify God in whatever I was going through that joy actually began to spring up. And let's be honest, who are you going to listen to more? Somebody that's talking about, oh, the Lord has blessed me. Let me tell you how good the Lord's been to me. Or somebody that you're looking at and going, I don't know how they even get out of bed in the morning. If I was dealing with what they were dealing with, I don't even think I could get out of bed. You ever walked into a nursing home, thought about this poor brother or sister in that nursing home, and then you walk out and you realize they got more joy than I do? Well, it's probably because they've learned to let go of trying to control and fix and just realize. I went into a nursing home room one time with this lady, and I went in and I started talking to her, and I felt so sorry for her. I can't get time for her story, but it was pitiful. It was so sad. And I went in there. You know what I went in there? I went in there to cheer her up. And I got in there and started talking to her. And she didn't want to hear anything I had to say. Here's what she said. She said, hey, how you doing? I heard you had a flare-up with your gout. Yeah, I have. Well, tell me about that. Are you doing okay? And then she went on and just talked. And I spent the next 20 minutes whining and crying and complaining about my gout to this poor little old bedridden lady in a nursing home on the verge of death. But you know what? She had figured out the secret. She could lay there and wallow in her misery. Or she could remember, I'm on this earth to magnify God. And we serve God best when we serve one another. And so she wanted to hear about my pain and my troubles. That's all I'm suggesting. Some of the pain that we have in life, nothing can fix it, nothing can take it away, nothing can stop it. It is what it is. But joy can get us through it. And if you want to be able to rejoice even in your struggles, you're going to have to find the purpose for your pain. And the Bible answer to that is, in life or in death, I can magnify God. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. He's going to close the letter with. Is there somebody tonight that needs to have a new purpose in their life? Maybe to this point you've been living for yourself. Maybe you've been living for retirement. You've been living for money, living for your job, living for... There's all kinds of stuff we live for. Maybe tonight you say, you know what? I realize the reason I don't have joy is because I'm living for all the wrong things. I'm not magnifying God. I'm magnifying all the wrong things, but I want to change that. We want to help you. We want to help you change that. We want you to be baptized into Jesus Christ so that you can rejoice in the Lord. If you haven't done that, do that tonight. Take that first step. This is the first step towards joy that cannot be taken away. If you have done that, but this other stuff has pulled you away, it's okay. It's happened to probably all of us. But take the step back to Jesus tonight, and we'll walk that step with you. If we can help you, just come forward while we stand and while we sing this song together.